Summer break is here. I want my kids to have fun, but I also want them to keep their skills sharp. Between vacations and sports, I need something that fits our busy schedule without adding stress. That's why we use IXL. IXL is an award-winning online platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL offers personalized interactive learning that adapts to each child's level and pace. It's proven to improve grades, and one subscription covers every child in the home, saving us time and money. It's trusted nationwide. And in fact, IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now, and listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Good evening, Browns fans, and welcome to Gang of Three. Currently a gang of two because Verizon is playing hell with Lane Atkins' internet connection right now. So if you work for AT&T and have a nice deal to switch, Lane might be in the position where he could answer that. How you doing, Pete?
All right, how are you?
I'm doing all right. You never sound like 100% enthusiastic about talking to me, Pete. Is there a reason for that?
Just thinking about the 9 more scouting report things I have to do before rookie minicamp.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of work ahead of us to really get our arms around this draft class, this UDFA class. But let's get on with it. Let's get to it. We've already got some questions in the chat room that we can deal with. Let's go over this draft here, Pete. Obviously, you know, the thing to me is that this seemed like a Baltimore Ravens draft to me, you know, which is intended as a compliment to a team that I hate. It's just that every pick sort of made sense. Everything was logical. There was some stuff on day three that you had to sort of understand a little bit and dig into, or I did at least, to really understand it. But, you know, the draft selections felt right. You know, everything was explainable. And I think that Browns fans are really relating to that with enthusiasm. And it's certainly tied close to the quote-unquote consensus draft boards. And so the Browns got pretty good grades on it. What grade do you give them?
That's interesting. You mentioned the consensus draft board, since that seems to be such a divisive topic.
It is.
The last couple of days. I would give them an A. I think there are some gambles they took. There's some volatility with some of the picks, like Emmanuel McNeil Warren. But look, I mean, I think they crushed day one. I think they absolutely knocked day one out of the park relative to what they were trying to do. And then day two, look, I'm not going to categorize guys necessarily as steals. I thought Denzel Boston went right where he should.
Mm-hmm.
I do think Emmanuel McNeil Warren is a value relative to that, considering I thought he was basically going to go around at the top of the second round. They got him at the end of the second round. So getting two first-round picks that are first-round picks and getting two second-round picks that are second-round picks is really good, and they created assets all over it. And so on top of everything else that they've done well, I like the Austin Barber pick as well. They came out of this draft with two fourth-round picks for next year, which I think is part of their whole process. But like, one of the things that continues to stand out to me is there's this conversation about, well, the Browns are going to have to trade Myles Garrett and all this other stuff. Except last year, they executed a draft trade that netted them more than the Cowboys got from Micah Parsons. So that's essentially trading one superstar away, and you did nothing. And then this year, they gave up even less. Granted, still three spots, but they gave up nothing because Yahoo article came out and confirmed that they would have taken Spencer Fano at six. So they moved down three spots and essentially created draft picks out of thin air, equivalent to the trade that the Minnesota Vikings made with the Philadelphia Eagles getting for Jonathan Grenard, getting 98th pick and a future third. So in essence, the Browns, without having moved down three spots in two drafts back to back, have gotten effectively a Micah Parsons trade and a Jonathan Grenard trade. So look, obviously these picks have to come to fruition and be effective. Otherwise, we are going to have to revisit this conversation again. But in the meantime, just by creating this surplus value over the course of this, which is obviously backfilling a giant hole they created for themselves, there's going to come a point where all of a sudden everybody's going to have to wrestle with the fact that Myles Garrett's best situation is to be on the Cleveland Browns, because they may be the best team for him, both in the short and long term. Now, that's going to take probably another season to get to that point, especially if we're sitting there looking at quarterback. But that's a significant outcome. Now, whether or not he feels that way, and he may be sitting there going, well, I'll believe it when I see it, unclear. But nevertheless, I think the Browns are trying to, rather than like sit there and, you know, sort of negotiate with him, they're just saying, we're going to do the stuff to build the team and try to make an attractive location for Myles Garrett and anyone else.
Right, right. One of the things that in chat username brings this up, I'll put his item on the screen here. You know, you read the Yahoo piece, which I really enjoyed. And, you know, everything's about all these computers and screens and all this data that they have and all this data that they've compiled. You know, they still have a guy who's in charge of analytics, but a lot of people are pointing to the exit of Di Podesta as a turning point. Do you agree with that at all? Do you think you can make that relation?
No, I'm not going to rule out the possibility that it's addition by subtraction. There may have been a streamlining of the process, but ultimately, like, Jack Duffin makes the right argument. There's no way Paul DePodesta was standing on the table going, take Jedrick Wills or take the kicker in the fourth round. Like, these are small differences deviations that make all the difference in the world. I think Catherine Hickman is a plus for this front office as well. But ultimately, I think so much of this is Andrew Berry has figured out how to do it. And
right.
I like the fact that there's a learning curve to this. But, like, it's the same. Like, did Paul DePodesta go and moonlight as in the Eagles front office when Howie Roseman was awful for the Eagles before he learned how to do it and then became arguably the best executive in football and won, you know, led that team to two Super Bowls? No, I mean, like, no. Putting this very easy bow on things isn't realistic. I think it's smart that the Browns have brought in consultants that can be helpful. I think just getting better at this, honing your processes, finding the right things in terms of beyond sort of the numbers and everything, which are certainly still a part of this whole thing. And as you mentioned, they have analytics people. That was not Paul DePodesta's job. They've gotten better at figuring out the right people they need to target as much as, you know, the speed and the impact and all that stuff. Like, that stuff's all there, but they have gotten better at it now. And ultimately, again, we're sitting here after the 2021 draft when they got, you know, Greg Newsom and JOK, people were ready to throw a parade for him. And Greg Newsom was a rock solid pick based on all the numbers and everything else. He was ultimately fine. Wasn't great. He was fine. JOK was great. And they got hurt. That's the difference between, like, some of these drafts. And yeah, there's other picks you can question, but like Siaki Ika wasn't a Paul DePodesta pick. Like, these are bad picks you can easily attribute.
Right. So
I just think there's a general evolution to this thing that Andrew Berry has got and the people around him have just gotten better at it. And that's a huge element to this.
Right. Right. Well, you know, let's go from the top of the draft down. We're getting some questions about some of the draft picks and some things like that. I will highlight here as we go through it. But Spencer Fano, as you pointed out, they were going to pick him at 6. Now, do you think that was true even if Carnell Tate was still on the board? You know, that seems to have – they certainly didn't panic when that happened, but it seems like they had a group of players perhaps that they were interested in and maybe not, you know, maybe we were just able to roll with it. But do you think that had any effect on it?
Unknown. I mean, I'd like to think they'd take the trade down anyway, because that would just give them more candidates that would be on the board for what they wanted, and they got a really good offer. We know from Lane's reporting that the Browns were pretty confident that they didn't think Carnell Tate was going to be on the board in the first place. Took that out of the equation, but that's a genuine unknown. Did the Browns view Carnell Tate as so good they would have taken him at six and not thought twice about it? Unclear. It works out really well for the Browns because there's no second guessing at that point.
Yeah.
Everybody has to just sort of accept the fact that he went fourth and wasn't even a consideration. So it looks all great because they wanted Spencer Fano and they got Spencer Fano. But that would have been had they taken the trade and say New Orleans took Carnell Tate after the fact, and whatever happened, some people would have been going back, well, of course they passed on the Ohio State receiver. They do this all the time, and given them the opening to second guess, which they've
right. All. Yeah, it's. Do you remember back in the day when Monroe Freeling was supposed to be the Browns pick, at number one, and it seems like they were really locked in on Fano the whole time.
Yeah, I mean. We did this last year. It's the same thing, like coming out of the combine, Monroe Freeling going to go at six. We did the same thing last year. Shedeur Sanders is absolutely going to go at two. I wish more people subscribe so they can find out better to the OBR. Right. But even so, like, they're not that predictable. And, if you believe in the consensus board and sort of track how the Browns have operated relative to the consensus board, Freeling was way down relative to that board. So if Barry was guided by that in any way, it didn't seem like that was going to be that would have been out of character for him to take Freeling at six. Now, the caveat to that was, had the Browns traded down to nine and taken Monroe Freeling, I think most people have been like, fine, maybe there's still some questions with Monroe Freeling, but they got picks and got him, so fine. Mm-hmm. Whereas for by and large, most people thought, I think on balance that Spencer Fano was the best tackle in the draft, and they got their guy.
Right. And he is now the face of the rebuild of this line. Browns left tackles, according to the little stat I've got from in here, allowed 16.2% pressure rate, worse than the league in 2025. And while Fano wasn't going against NFL quality competition, he allowed a 1.11% or 1.1% pressure rate last season. So a little bit of improvement expected in the past game. And that was third best among all the qualifying tackles. Do you think that Fano has a particular strength to his game? Is it pass protection, or is he just all around what you're looking for in the left tackle?
To me, he's a weapon in run blocking. Like, his pass protection is going to take some time to figure out, because he played mm-hmm. a scheme that utilized a whole lot of tight ends. They used a lot of quick passes. He had something like in the 400 range of true passing sets over the course of 3 years, which is a good number, but overall is lower for people who play that many snaps. And a lot of that seemingly was to me to be protect the quarterback more than the lineman.
Right.
The bottom line is, like, there is stuff he's going to need to figure out, mostly experience, just see it, that part of it. No, I think his strength is run blocking. He is an absolute weapon in terms of getting on the move, getting the second level, being able to wheel up and hit moving targets. I will be very curious to see just how much they have him move, because he's so good at it. But I think Quinshon Judkins is going to love Spencer Fano, because so much of what he does is the recipe for explosive plays, because he's so quick to the second level. He just overwhelms linebackers. And if the Browns just hit the first level blocks they're supposed to on something like trap, Quinshon Judkins is good enough. He's going to crease that and make a big play. So the effort piece is there. I will be very curious to see if Fano sort of rubs off on other people, because he's going to work hard enough that it's going to make other guys look bad if they don't.
Right. Right. And, you absolutely love to have that sort of guy in the locker room and on the field. And the Browns are very enthusiastic about him, certainly as a person, in addition to being a ball player. What do you think he allows the Browns to do differently on offense. You know, they're going to put him over on the left side. Monken didn't seem to have any doubt at all that he was a left tackle. Compared to having DeJuan Jones or Cam Robinson out there, you know, what's the play calling difference? Are you just more confident going to the left side, or, you know, what can Monken do now that he couldn't do before?
No, what I like is the fact that he can go, he's going to be providing advantage between both sides. And I like the fact that he's on the left, because I assume the Browns are going to maintain being a right-handed offense. So when they run zone to the right, Fano is athletic enough to get that backside cutoff, which is just hustling to cut off a player. And so if Quinshon Judkins sees a cutback lane, Spencer Fano is the one who can open it up. Likewise, if they want to run counter or power or stuff that's going to ask him to wheel or move the kick out going from left to right, he can do that. But going to the left, he's athletic enough, they want to run zone, that he's going to reach block. Basically, he's athletic enough, he could theoretically reach block anybody they put that out there on the end man in the line of scrimmage. He can get to space immediately. He's going to be a huge weapon in the screen game because he's just so nimble and he's good at right. hitting moving targets. How well he's going to be at, down blocks, base blocks in the NFL right away is going to be proven. But I think his ability to go from a double team to pass off to then go to the second level is going to be a real asset on that. So he really opens things up. But that's why I like him better on the left side, sort of as the backside player to a right-handed offense. And then giving them more viability to the left side than they've had in several seasons.
I got a couple of questions coming off of this, and we can talk about the wide receivers. Phantom, Barber, Brailsford, right? Three new offensive linemen in this draft. Is there a common theme that sort of runs through all three of those guys, you know, that sort of says, here's a new philosophy, or here's what our philosophy is going to be as an offense? You know, do they have sort of complementary skills, or are they that good at different things, I guess is what I'm asking.
All three guys are athletic. And Zion Johnson, the biggest signing they made, also an elite athlete. Titus Howard, I don't know where I keep hearing people suggest that Titus Howard is a power player. He is not. He's a zone guy. Now, granted, I think the Browns want to run power and do those things, but like Tevin Jenkins, also athletic. That is the big theme. All these guys are going to be able to run zone and cause teams problems in terms of their ability to get out and on the move, reach blocks, working in space, those type of things. And then, you know, particularly for the tackles they brought in, they're both pricks, which I'm all about. they are mean, and they look for work. But Parker Brailsford, also extraordinarily athletic. Todd Monken made a point of that. I mean, it was a little surprising they picked him because they picked another light center, but he emphasized just how important it was to have movement skills. And then obviously when you're the center and Parker Brailsford started like 42 games, they must feel good about his ability to lead the line, make the calls, and put them in the right positions. I do enjoy the fact that the Browns are theoretically counting on a group that includes a guy named Spencer, Parker, and Austin to be badass pricks up front to hurt guys' opponents.
I guess the name does not fate you to a certain destiny in life. But the other question I had, I know we've touched on this in previous weeks. You know, so many new components. Right. You know, Brailsford, you know, I wonder if he is going to provide the sort of capability that allows them to put Jenkins at guard, you know, and worry a little bit less about the center position. But all in all, you know, some flexibility with these guys. How long do you think it takes for them, you know, for this mixed veteran young group to come together as a unit, right? Be able to communicate. Should Browns fans be expecting difficulties those first couple of weeks? Or do you think it's something that happens in training camp if it's going to happen at all?
So this is complicated. On the one hand, it's why I think they said Spencer Fano, you're the left tackle. One, he needs all the reps he can get, particularly pass protection. But I think they I think they understand the fact that they are basically bringing in an entire new line, that they need those guys to be in place as fast as possible. So Fano is going to be at left tackle. I have every reason to believe Zion Johnson, who's also really athletic, is going to be left guard. Mm-hmm. And the right tackle is going to be Titus Howard. But the fact that they went with the approach they did makes me wonder how long it's going to take for them to decide on center and guard. Because if Parker Brailsford gets into camp and they decide, uh-oh, this guy's not ready for Sunday, Jenkins basically has to be that guy. Now, the other part of that is if they feel really good about Parker Brailsford, then they can move Elton Jenkins to right guard and suddenly figure that out. I think they need to decide that pretty quickly in order to get to what you're doing, because they are bringing in so many pieces, because they are trying to do all this at the same time. I think they want to get to those answers as quick as possible. The problem is there's enough variables to sit there and go, yes, we want to make this decision, but we might have to hold off longer than we'd like, at least on those two spots.
All right. So let's move on to the wide receivers. We spent about 20 minutes talking about offensive tackle. We've talked about Concepcion's drops, quote unquote, time and time again. We do have a question about them. Let me see if I can find it here. And the question is whether those drops are fixable, whether it's something we need to live with. I think sort of an unstated third question there is, as Mike Lukovic points out here, that he was surprised in the amount of drops that were actually allotted to him given the quarterback play. But in general, is it a concern? Is it something you expect to see that we just have to live with?
I think there's a component of it that you will have to live with. I mean, there are times where he's playing so fast and then slaps at the ball that he doesn't catch it. Hopefully he can improve on it. Todd Monken seems to believe he can improve it or knows how to fix it, which would be great. Obviously, the trade-off is, on the one hand, Concepcion will drop some passes. On the other hand, he will also make spectacular catches. The other component with drops, and this is true of Jerry Jeudy last year for me, is timing and accuracy. When the ball's on time and the ball was accurate, Jerry Jeudy was really good. When the ball wasn't on time and wasn't accurate, Jerry Jeudy wasn't as good, and we put all of that on Jerry Jeudy. A lot of that was on the quarterback play, and that's true of Concepcion, who played with quarterbacks named Brennan Thompson, C.J. Bailey as a freshman, and then finished with Marcel Reed, and one of the most highest off-target rates of any quarterback he played with. Like, he was not playing with C.J. Stroud. He was not playing with Julian Sayin, who are really accurate passers. He was playing with guys who were scattering the ball all over the field. That uncertainty can cause some problems. So is he going to drop some balls? Yeah, CeeDee Lamb drops balls. Jamar Chase drops balls. The issue is going to be, what's the rate of explosive plays and touchdowns and plays that you love versus the plays that, you know, the drop? Is it going to be a situation where it's like Jerry Jeudy 2024, where nobody seemed to have a problem with Jerry Jeudy the few drops he had, because he dropped balls then because he had 1,200 yards and all those touchdowns? Mm-hmm. 2025, it wasn't as productive, so people had issues with the drops. It's always going to be a question of variance. I think Concepcion is going to be more reliable than Jeudy. But I think, you know, it's one of those things where he might have a year where it's higher, or he might have a year that's super low, and you're going to have to sort of accept that on some level.
Right. And, of course, they got Denzel Boston, who was expected to go, you know, late first round, early second. They double-dipped on wide receivers. And so I've sort of got the same question about Jeudy, Concepcion, and Boston as I had about the offensive line, which is whether these are complementary skills. In other words, do you see all three of those guys playing at the same time in clearly defined roles? Are these guys complementary to Jerry Jeudy, or are they basically, you know, Boston perhaps, or Concepcion, sort of a replacement for Jerry Jeudy? You know, is there, you know, an overlap of skills, or is each one bringing something unique to the table?
I think the group actually fits together really well. I think that's why the Browns ultimately pulled the trigger on Denzel Boston, because they do all fit well. I think you can take Harold Fannin, Jerry Jeudy, Casey Concepcion, Denzel Boston, put them all in the field and just jumble them up in a variety of packages. Obviously, you could just throw them out wherever because Denzel Boston has experience on the outside. He has experience in the power slot. He has he lined up in the backfield a couple times for Washington, did a lot of fan in stuff at points. Concepcion can line up on the outside, inside, can motion, do all that stuff. Jerry Jeudy's already done all these things. He's been outside, inside. Harold Fannin moves all over the place. So long as these guys can pick up the playbook, I think Todd Monken is going to consistently jumble up where they are in given situations and given games as much as he can, because that's going to put the defense at the most difficult position. If they want to, you know, theoretically in the world, this doesn't happen, but like they just want to play basketball and man up across the board, then he's going to force guys to chase them all over the field. If they're playing zone, he's going to jumble them up to try to find the best matchups. That is going to take time to sort of figure out just how quickly they can pick that up and do it. But most of these guys, whether it's Boston or Concepcion, they've done this consistently in college, and we've already seen Jeudy do it. We've seen Fannin do it. They seem able to do it. So I think that's going to be the theme, is they got guys that can just be thrown around all over the place. The guys that I don't think can do some of that stuff still have a real value, which is somebody like Isaiah Bond. He's almost consistently going to be lined up outside and just run really deep post and seam type routes, which is fine. He's going to create space and create opportunities for these other guys to sort of take advantage of that. But like everybody else, I think it's just going to be a moving piece.
Okay. Fair enough. And, you know, given the Concepcion's drops, the skills of these particular wide receivers, this top three that we're going to throw out there, do you think that the way that they play ties closer to one of the quarterbacks than the others? In other words, you know, you get somebody like Deshaun Watson, you may not know where the ball is coming from on each play because he tends to move around a great deal. Of course, Shadur retreats as well. But, you know, in terms of accuracy and play style, do you think that there's any sort of that the assembly of wide receivers that we have now gives any sort of edge to any of our, you know, particular quarterbacks?
Only in the sense that, like, it's one more reason to lean youth because mm-hmm. you've got young receivers. And if the young quarterbacks, one of the three, shows something, then there's reason to see if they can grow with those guys. Whereas Deshaun Watson, is it not going to be here next year? So it doesn't really matter.
Right.
Yeah, but from a schematic standpoint, not really. I just think Todd Monken's offense will cater to whoever is at quarterback and try to work as well as possible with that guy. I don't see something that says, well, because they got Concepcion and Boston, that says insert players should start.
Right, right. In terms of the quarterback, sort of the same question with the offensive line. You know, the offensive line needs to know where that quarterback is. They need to understand where that quarterback is, especially I would think a young offensive line. Again, does that sort of lead you to one quarterback or another? You know, does one of them you think have a tendency to sort of improvise where they are or not be where the offensive line thinks they're going to be?
Well, if I base it off last season, that would lead to Dylan Gabriel. He's the most able to be where he's supposed to be of the three. But I don't think it's going to matter. And one of the areas that Shadur needs to improve the most is his footwork and understanding of where he needs to be in the pocket. So we'll see if that has gotten better. With Deshaun, I mean, he was just such a mess in terms of when he pulled the ball down, when he dropped his eyes and all this other stuff. He just was terrible at it. So those are areas that those guys have to get better. Now, if the offensive line shows well and can sort of be functional early, that should hopefully garner some trust from the quarterbacks and hopefully eliminate some of the bad habits. But ultimately, they've got to do it.
Right, right. Okay, well, let's roll on to what a lot of people are calling steal in this draft, which is Emmanuel McNeil Warren, the safety out of Toledo. You know, mocked in the first round frequently. I saw him mocked in the Browns at 24 and they got him at 58. Any idea why he fell, Pete, or did the Browns just sort of luck out with a, you know, player just sort of fell through the crack?
Well, there's two elements that can factor into that. I mean, I don't know that falling out of the first round is necessarily true, but falling to 58 is true in a sense. And I think a lot of the mocking him to the Browns was because people knew that the Browns liked him. But yeah, he was mocked the first round quite a bit. One is we always overrate how early safeties are going to go. We all thought Caleb Downs was going to go in the top 5, 6, whatever. He goes 11. Then Dylan Thienemann doesn't go until 25, and a lot of people thought he was going to go something where like 18. So that naturally pushes these guys down. And then the other part of that is fit. There may have been people that just thought that Emmanuel McNeil Warren didn't fit what they wanted to do with the safety position, and the Browns felt good about it. Last but not least, just priorities. It just may not have been a priority to attack that. They may have, you know, Emmanuel McNeil Warren may have finished second in a lot of races for some of these teams where because of some of the things that happened in the first round or picks that were made that were unexpected. Let's say Ty Simpson at 13 or Keelan Rutledge at 26 or Kenyon Sadiq at 16 or Deshaun Stribling at 33, that maybe some of these players that fell, Denzel Boston being a good example. I mean, that literally was the situation for the Browns. Emmanuel McNeil-Warren seemingly finished second at 39 for the pick to Denzel Boston. So that may have been a chain effect that happened more than a few times. But so much of this is just, it's one of those positions we always think is going to go super, super early. We did with Kyle Hamilton. We've done with some of these other, Ed Reed. We just always worry how they're going to go. And then we all think they've fallen way too far.
Right, right. Well, what does McNeil Warren do particularly well? You know, I guess I'm sort of wondering, you know, you have Ronnie Hickman back there. What can the Browns do with McNeil Warren in the defensive backfield that they weren't able to do before? You know, what difference is he going to make in that defensive backfield?
Well, there's a couple of choices they have to make in terms of how they want to run their scheme. I think they're going to play more too high this year with this move. And in that sense, McNeil Warren can do a couple of things. He can play deep and roll down and, in essence, be aggressive playing forward because that's what he's done really well and be a intimidating hitter. He can also theoretically play in the box. He needs to prove himself at the NFL, but he has covered tight ends before, which allows them to with some flexibility with how they've used Grant Delpit since in Jim Schwartz's time here. Grant Delpit was essentially chained to whoever the top tight end was because he was so good at it. But it also makes you a little bit predictable knowing that Grant Delpit's going to cover the tight end. I think that had a huge impact on the interception Grant Delpit had against the Green Bay Packers because the Green Bay Packers thought, well, he's going to cover the tight end and didn't account for him on the slant, and he threw the pick. So they're going to utilize those three players and change up their roles on any given play. So if they can do it, and it's going to depend on McNeil Warren's development curve. On any given play, he can be in the slot slash box, free or strong. The other thing the biggest reason they got him is length and turnovers. He is huge. Like one of the things that stood out on tape with Carson Switzer last year is just how much space he takes up on the field. He is a giant human being. Manny McNeil Warren is also a giant human being. He's 6'3". He's got pretty long arms. So, like, you get a number of these players on the field. Like, it just takes up the amount of space you have. And if they're athletic, it just feels like there's nowhere to go. But Manny McNeil Warren has a knack for causing turnovers. He's got that big punch. He likes to knock the ball out. He's made some interceptions. He's a gambler in that respect. So they're going to have to do some stuff to try to hone his instincts on when to gamble. But given... if the Browns are going to continue to play man coverage as much as they do with their corners, they need their safeties to make cause turnovers. The Browns said this has been a theme. One of the things we are always talking about is why aren't the Browns causing more turnovers? So they went and added a player specifically who has a tendency to cause turnovers. So that's going to be a main thrust for him. But I think they're going to run more disguised looks, some more trap coverages, and things that are going to allow them to try to catch opponents by the surprise. So if the quarterback's feeling pressure by, you know, from the pass rush or whatever, all of a sudden he just sees something wrong and throws the ball up. Hopefully the Browns are capitalizing on it with a turnover of some sort.
Okay, that sounds fair. It sounds like flexibility is a key word here, you know, in terms of making it work, giving them, you know, additional things that they can do, games that they can play with the offense. All right, well, let's jump down to selection number 9. Mr. Green from Arkansas. Very interesting player. How many developmental quarterbacks can you wide into a quarterback room? Do they really have the luxury of taking on a guy like Taylen Green who may or may not develop? The reason I ask this is that Jacoby Brissett is probably going to be on the trading block. A guy I'd really be interested in, but now you've got 4 guys, one of whom you can't get rid of, one of whom you're not going to want to get rid of, and Sanders. And then you got Green and Gabriel. Sort of.
We sure we don't want to get rid of Sanders? We'll see. Look, the bottom line is this is all dependent on Green. Because if Green right. can show something, really enough, that he can be active on game day, you're going to want him on your football team. Because if he's active on game day, he's going to do a couple of things, I think, right out of the gate. 4th and 1, you're going to want that kid in the ball game, running something. We've seen this. I mean, what's really funny is all the things that people hated about Kevin Stefanski, Todd Monken's going to steal a lot of them because it's just smart. Last year, the Browns ran so much with Quinshon Judkins as the Wildcat quarterback. Okay. I'll just have the 6'6", 230-pound kid who can run a 4.3 do the zone read with Quinshon Judkins inside the 10-yard line. Great. Defend that. Like, that's where the upside of Taylen Green is. If he can be good enough that he warrants being one of the 46 players active on game day, he's going to help this team score touchdowns in the red zone. That's undeniable, and they should use him. 4th down, 3rd and short. Put him on the field, especially if you're not confident in your quarterback situation. He's going to be a weapon. Overall, my thought process on this is take swings. Now, I didn't want to draft a quarterback before round 5, but personally, my preference would have been to take an undrafted quarterback. But I was thrilled with Taylen Green in the 6th round, one, because they traded down, it picked around 5 to create the 6th round pick. So it was essentially free anyway. But if he's a lottery ticket, and, if you hit, you hit the jackpot. If you don't, you can move on to the next one. You're not that attached to him. Like, you could, there's a scenario where Taylen Green doesn't make the active roster and he's ultimately put on the practice squad or something along those lines. So the scenario they've put forth, at least right now, is these guys have to earn that roster spot, which I don't hate. People are going to get whined about reps and all that, which is fine. I take them away from Deshaun Watson, but that's me. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, they need to find a guy who can play. And if the answer is none of these guys are that good, I'm not that worried about getting more reps for one of them.
Yeah, I guess my concern is if you want to keep Taylen Green around because he can be effective on 3rd and 4th down, doesn't that almost force you to dump Dylan Gabriel somewhere? I don't see how he fits in this room since you can't get rid of Watson.
Well, I mean, it's ultimately going to be dictated by what happens on the field. Like, yes, Shador is probably ahead right now. But if Dylan Gabriel goes out there and plays well in practice and all this other stuff, there's nothing that prevents him from stealing that job. Now, even if you think it's a foregone conclusion that Dylan Gabriel is going to go, the best case scenario for the Browns is that he practices well and gets teams to be interested in him potentially for a trade. Or you get a similar circumstance to last year where Kenny Pickett got traded to the Raiders after Aiden O'Connell got injured and the Browns got a 5th round pick. In fact, that was one of the picks the Browns used in this, I think that may have been the pick they traded the Seahawks. Regardless, if Dylan Gabriel fares well, and I think he will be certainly better than he was last year, even if it's just in the preseason where he looked pretty good, he might get teams interested enough to give up something for him if they're in a tight spot. And I think that's the best plan going forward is develop them as much as you can. And then when the time comes, maybe you can get something for them. One of them, anyway.
Right. It's never a problem having too many good quarterbacks. Right now, we've got four unknowns really at quarterback. We talked a lot about Brissett during the draft game, or you guys did behind the scenes, but I just don't see any way that, you know, they could fit him into this roster at this point, unless you want to take a chance on throwing away one of the quarterbacks you've drafted over the last couple of years. There's just not enough roster spots.
Maybe. The other thing that happened last year is we ended up the Browns ended up having to sign a quarterback because all the guys were hurt. So the injury element is a factor for the Browns as much as anyone else.
True. All right. Well, let's go to some of the questions that we have here that have piled up over the course of the hour. If you have questions for Pete, feel free to fire away. E. Gillen wants to know about fullback. At what point, you know, Browns apparently today signed a veteran fullback, but E. Gillen was wondering if Carson Ryan might have a shot at that role as well.
Perhaps. I mean, he's a utility guy. He's not an inline player, so I could see him getting shot. The other guy that I haven't seen any confirmation on the veteran fullback that was mentioned, but what I have seen was the Browns agreed to a undrafted free agent contract with TJ Harden at SMU. I think he's going to get a shot at fullback. And I think he could be really good at it if he proves able to block. TJ Harden played at SMU this past year, and I don't really find anything he did at SMU all that interesting. However, for the two previous years, he was at UCLA, and I do find that interesting because at UCLA he had to combine like 50 receptions for 400-something yards. In fact, one of those years he was the second leading receiver on the team because UCLA's passing offense was atrocious. But he had like 386 yards and was second on the team. So he's 6'2", 220. He's got the size for it. So if he can block and do those nice little things like catch passes out of the backfield confidently, he sort of gives you that vibe of that West Coast fullback style where he can come in and do some blocking work. And then occasionally, every so often, he just catches a ball out in the flat. Nobody's paying attention to him when he gets a first down or something like that. He's actually got pretty good balance in terms of bouncing off tacklers. He just doesn't seem to get much after breaking a tackle. But nevertheless, like, just looking at him, I'll be very curious if that's not exactly the role they have in mind for him. There's also another kid they signed or agreed to a deal with out of Mississippi State that might be in the same thought process, though I'm not as confident with that one. Harden's just bigger and has to me, a perfect skill set.
Right. Well, we added two tight ends during the draft. We already had a bunch of tight ends on the roster. Do you see anyone with a clear path to becoming that tight end too? You know, out of this group, that now includes Royer and Ryan?
Well, I mean, I am not satisfied or confident based on what they've done to this point. I really like Carson Ryan, but he's not an inline tight end, so that doesn't really help there. But he could be. He's actually got the eerily similar athletic profile to Harold Fannin, even though they are completely different players. He was really productive for BYU, but he's shorter, so he's more of a space move tight end type. Joe Royer, your boy, is 24 years old. He was a receiving tight end for Cincinnati. He has never been a good blocker. And the one thing that I found that is interesting and sort of casually looking up stuff on Joe Royer is most of the blocking was in zone, which might cater well to what the Browns are doing, but I think the Browns are going to have to get blocking out of him because to this point he's got the body for it. He might be an intriguing weapon as a pass catcher. I don't think he's your answer as a true Y. So I'll be curious to see. Obviously, look, I don't think the Browns are going to do anything until they get to rookie minicamp and see what these guys can do. And, you know, they may come out of these guys are interesting, or they may do the thing where they go, wow, this guy can't play a lick, and then go, we got to get help. But I don't look at Joe Royer as an answer for that. And I don't know that the Browns do either. He can line up in that spot, but I think he's more of a pass catching threat. And they're not that attached to him. I mean, it's a fifth round pick, 170. It's not a huge investment. So, you know, I could easily see them saying, even if they keep Joe Royer and they like Joe Royer, they may sit there and go, we can do better than insert other guy that they've got, whether it's Jack Stoll, Blake Whitehart, or Brendan Bates. None of these guys are like guaranteed anything. So that continues out where I think the Browns could look for opportunities. David Njoku is going to be the name that comes up. The other one I'd keep an eye out on is Cole Kmet of the Chicago Bears. Chicago Bears, he's got a sizable cap figure this year. Then on top of every other reason, the Bears might want to move him. They used the third round pick to take Sam Roush, the tight end of Stanford, to pair with Colston Loveland. So they've got three tight ends, and maybe they're content with that, but that could also be them signaling that they're willing to move on from a Cole Kmet, which would be an upgrade for the Browns.
Yeah, certainly would be. Right now it looks like a bunch of guys fighting for a couple of jobs, and maybe even the same thing at fullback with this Michael Burton, who was supposedly signed, according to Tony Grossi, earlier today. And then you got Carson Ryan, you've got the UDFA that you were talking about. So maybe we'll see a battle in camp, you know, for those couple of positions. So chat username wants to know, how did we do with undrafted free agents? And here's a list of undrafted free agents, at least at last counting, in our UDFA article.
These are the guys that have reportedly agreed to actual contracts as opposed to tryout players, which there are more of those, but obviously not signed, so they could just not show up. And maybe they're trying to recreate what they did last year, where they had basically a full team minicamp, which I thought was actually really smart. I hope they do the same thing, but we'll see. But in terms of guys that I think are interesting, could actually maybe be something that's, you know, potentially worth keeping. TJ Harden, I already mentioned. Logan Fennell's got a shot. There are people who really like him. He's not necessarily a guy I really like all that much, but the edge room is there. There's a spot to win, I think. As a result, I also think Tyreek Sapp could be interesting. Tyreek Sapp is a very powerful defensive end, had a very good 2024 season, a very down 2025 season, why he went undrafted. We'll see. He doesn't really do a whole lot else. He's not particularly polished as a pass rusher, but he is really strong. Davin Booth, the other running back I mentioned, I'm not as confident with that one. I think Harden's the better option. Cole Wilson's interesting. I don't know how great his shot is. He is small. He has shades of player that the Falcons just drafted in round three out of Georgia. He's really good with the ball in his hands. He's actually a better receiver, I think, down the field, and really good as a kick returner. But the Browns' wide receiver room is going to be really difficult. So he's essentially got to beat out somebody like Malachi Corley, which will be tough unless Malachi Corley gets hurt. Michael Coach is one I think is worth keeping an eye on. Corner out of West Virginia. The year before, he played at Nevada. Really good athletic profile. Was really productive at Nevada. Pretty good at West Virginia. I think he has a lot of the characteristics the Browns like. So he's one where I think, and the Browns, you know, this is another one where I think the Browns want to see what these guys can do in camp before they go looking for more help, because it's fair to argue that the Browns need more corners, more corner help. They didn't draft one. That was a position that we thought and they thought maybe they were going to address in this draft. They haven't done it, so there's a spot to be won. Aaron Anderson is interesting. Another player like Tyreek Sapp, down 2025 season, was productive in 2024. He, as a sophomore that year, led LSU in receiving when Garrett Nussmeier had his best season. Also small. Just the fact that he led LSU as opposed to, say, Akron in receiving is an interesting enough step, but an interesting enough achievement to say don't write him off entirely. Zion Washington is interesting entirely because of the size of him and his athleticism. He might be a guy that I think he's got like 4.3 speed at 6'1", like 200 and something pounds, which is good. I think his chances of making the team are entirely as a matter of special teams. I don't know that he's going to show enough at safety. I don't know that the Browns have enough room at safety, but I could see a world where he's an absolute missile on special teams, and that part's going to be interesting. But those are the guys that sort of jump out to me. Maybe somebody else is going to do something that's notable, but the profiles on the other guys don't stand out. Like DeCarlos Nicholson is 25 years old. He's never been productive. And his whole thing is he's tall. He's 6'3". Okay. But, you know, we'll see if he shows something in camp. He's a press corner. Maybe there's something there. But the rest of these guys, nothing all that notable.
You know, looking over this list, and thanks for running down the guys who might be of interest. The one thing about looking at this list and this page is the total absence of offensive guards. Willie here says, I like Fano, but I hate that they missed out on Ione. I said I pronounced it. Pregnon and Keelon Rutledge. They didn't go after any guards. Pregnon actually fell in the draft, if I remember correctly, right? He was available a little bit later on. Were you surprised by that?
No, he's 24.
Okay. That rules him out.
This is the thing. Like, all these, you know, I get into this every year, and then we watch some of these guys fall, and this is the same thing. Like, I would have loved Keelon Rutledge. I think he's a tremendous player. Chase Bisantis went immediately. Mm-hmm. Emmanuel Pregnon going in the late second round is probably about right. If he doesn't start immediately, it's going to feel very bad to have used a second round pick on him and watch him sit on the bench. Like, that's the element of taking players that are older like that. So I had no interest in Emmanuel Pregnon. Wasn't really in love with Vega, not because Vega Ioane is a bad player by any stretch. I just questioned if he fit what the Browns want to do, and having seen what they've done, I can have questions if he fits what they really want to do, because he's not necessarily a great mover. He's a terrific player in a phone booth and does all that stuff, but I don't know if that's a great fit. But yeah, guard was something I wanted them to attack, because I think guard is more difficult to get right than center. I think they're more premium than center. I'll be curious if they want to try to move somebody into guard, whether that's KG Leviston, whether that's somebody else I'm not thinking of, or, you know, they're holding out hope that Joel Bitonio is going to come save the day or something. I don't know. But like, if this is how they roll, or they're that confident in Brailsford that Elton Jenkins and Tevin Jenkins can lock down that other spot. But one of the things I will be looking for next year for this team will be guard again, because I think that's going to be the one position now, hopefully, if Brailsford is what they hope he is, and Austin Barber looks interesting as a potential developmental guy to eventually start, it's going to be getting that other guard spot locked down.
Right. All right, a couple more questions we're going to go through, then we're going to wrap this sucker up. BCS20 says, who may be a post-June 1 cut after the draft? Anything change in the room, looking for upgrades, et cetera, et cetera. Anybody who stands out to you as a potential post-June 1 cut, given the talent that we just brought in?
Not really, because the NFL has largely solved that problem, because you get the multiple designations. Teams have gotten better at managing the cap. Most of those players that would be June 1st cuts are already cut. Could something else happen? Maybe. I just don't know that you're going to see anything that's all that interesting. More than likely, if you're going to get something, it's going to be in a form of a trade, because, again, teams have gotten better at managing their cap, and they're not putting themselves in a position where they need to cut some of these players.
Right. You know, the Browns didn't have unlimited draft picks, so I'm sort of, you know, sitting here looking at this list. There's no offensive guards. You know, it would have been nice. The other thing we didn't, you know, the other position we didn't draft was cornerback, right, which has become almost an annual tradition, right, for Andrew Berry to pick up another cornerback. I guess, you know, looking at our defensive backfield right now, our starting defensive backfield, you get two former number one picks, two number two picks at safety. You know, the front line is strong, but do you see them going out there and, you know, looking at Martin Emerson again, you know, if his price comes down to a reasonable level, or, you know, someone else to bolster that secondary?
I don't know if they're necessarily going to have to try to, like, bargain down Martin Emerson. I think ultimately they want to see what the guys they're bringing in can do. Mm-hmm. If they're surprised by somebody, great. And then ultimately after like rookie minicamp and maybe potentially, you know, right after the June minicamp when they go on summer vacation, they may, you know, they may say, you know, if you're not getting the offer you want, and they won't say this, but Martin Emerson's no fool. He knows Denzel Ward's going to miss a month. Right. That may be the fastest path to the field, sign a one-year deal, prove you are healthy, and then re-enter the market next year, and hopefully you can get the big contract you want. And it could be here, because the Browns are ultimately may be in a world where they want to sort of start planning for a post-Denzel Ward world, and maybe Martin Emerson can fill that void. But yeah, corner is going to be something they want to address. They can't have enough. Now, having said that, Emmanuel McNeil Warren may be part of their thought process on addressing that. Certainly, you need a slot corner. They have guys like Miles Harden and stuff like that. But like, they may want to operate in a world where they, when they have five DBs on the field, it's the three safeties and the two corners more than anything else. You've got this major asset you got. So unless, you know, even if Emmanuel McNeil Warren is so good that he just beats out Ronnie Hickman for that spot, and you've got Delpit and Emmanuel McNeil Warren, then Hickman's still probably going to be your best fifth guy. So, obviously personnel and matchups are going to dictate some of that stuff, but like, there's no reason for them not to lean into that. And I think that's a huge part of what Rutenberg wants to do. I'm imagining that some of this is trying to make the defense faster. So when they play team bigger and faster. So when they play teams that like want to use a whole bunch of tight ends, they don't feel compelled to take a safety off the field and put a linebacker on the field. I think they want to be in a position where they feel good about Emmanuel McNeil Warren. Then they could just sit there and go, okay, we're going to let you do this, and we're just going to keep playing three safeties and feel good about it. Now that's, they've got to prove that, but nevertheless, I think Emmanuel McNeil Warren gives them a dynamic that's going to allow them to be more confident in their personnel groups, regardless of some of what they face off in terms of what other teams are throwing at them. But yes, always look on the lookout for DBs. I mean, what's interesting to me is they just in the safety room, they've got the three guys we mentioned. They've got Donovan McMillan coming back. They've got Chris Edmonds coming back. They've got they are bringing in DeCarlos Nicholson to try out. They've got a couple of guys that they're bringing in to try out. Like, they never stop looking at that position. Ephraim Banda is always on the lookout for more guys. So that part they seem to understand. The corner ones, I think the one where if they don't make, you know, unless like the guy I mentioned from West Virginia, unless he's like a stud that they didn't see coming, I have to imagine something else is going to be done. Yes, they brought in the guys that they had last year and shut down the Cincinnati Bengals. So maybe they're really confident based on that, that Cincinnati could, with Joe Burrow, Ja'Marr Chase, and T. Higgins, could not solve D'Angelo Ross and what's his name, losing Browns may have given them a false sense of security.
Well, we'll see if that disappears over the course of the summer. Just a couple more, and then we're going to wrap up here. This is from Big Arasta, and he's asking about Todd Monken's offensive philosophy, asking if it's going to be a Lamar Jackson type of offense. I don't know if you can have a Lamar Jackson type of offense without Lamar Jackson. You know, he's such a special talent, but you know, does the drafting of Taylor Green tell you anything about what Monken is looking for, or was he just such a special athlete that you wanted to take a flyer?
Well, I think Taylor Green's a preview of where Todd Monken would like to go if he could find the right guy to do it. But having said that, Todd Monken is most likely has one giant playbook, and it's just a question of what section he wants to work from. Now, as I mentioned earlier, if Taylor Green can impress them enough that he becomes a viable option, you can get the Lamar Jackson type of offense in terms of they're going to do a whole lot of passing concepts that are traditional drop back, maybe to move the pocket a little bit, but then they bring in Taylor Green to take advantage of the other stuff that Lamar Jackson could do with his legs on some pure running stuff that he may have done at varying points of his career. So it just depends on where they can go. If Taylor Green, you know, again, scratch off lottery ticket, can become next Colin Kaepernick, yeah, that's where this thing's going to go. But until they have that guy, they're going to work from different parts of the playbook that, yes, Ravens, you know, the Ravens were able to employ, but with a very Browns-specific feel to it, because that's the personnel he's got.
Right, right. One final question is from David Eisler, I believe you pronounce it. He said, let's go, guys. Tell me the Browns will win the Super Bowl before my 30th anniversary with the OBR. I think it's about my 30th anniversary with the OBR, but he's got within the next 6 years. Mina Kimes put something together, just a quick tweet. I think it was Mina Kimes, who said, you know, boy, the Browns have done a good job sort of with the infrastructure. Get a quarterback in 2027 and just they're in good shape, you know. Do you view it that way, Pete? Are they a quarterback away?
I am not somebody who does dynasty football, but there are people who do dynasty football who are saying basically bet on whichever team, whether it's the Jets or the Browns, can finally get the answer to quarterback as being that team that's going to take off based on everything they've done. Obviously, if it was that easy, both teams would have done it. But we'll see. I mean, if the Browns can find a quarterback, I mean, everybody fundamentally is a quarterback away when it boils down to it. But yeah, the Browns have done a lot to fix a lot of the holes. And I think even people who came into this, and obviously, again, I can't say this enough, they have to prove it. But I think even some skeptics who came to this going, oh, the Browns aren't going to be able to draft their way out of this. They've got at least another year or two, maybe sitting there going, maybe we're closer than I thought we were.
Right.
Now, that could be a very fleeting feeling, depending on how this thing goes. But they've at least given you, for the based on the last 2 years of drafting, they've at least given you, some fans, the reason to start thinking about what is possible.
Well, I like that. I like the optimism. I think there's a lot of optimism right now after this draft class. Andrew Berry going 2 for 2, back-to-back home runs, hopefully. Of course, you can never tell for the first couple, for 3 years or however long, whether or not you really got the draft class you think you have. But it appears that we've done very well 2 years in a row, and that makes me very optimistic about the Browns. And I hope it does you too, if you're watching the show. Make you optimistic about what this year and next year could bring for the Cleveland Browns. Pete, it's been a pleasure, as always, my friend, chatting with you over the course of the last hour. I always learned stuff. Thank you to everyone who watched. Everybody in the chat room hitting us up with questions and comments throughout the show. It's great. Really enjoyed seeing you. And we will be back again next week with yet another edition of Gang of Three. Good night, everybody.